Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew, where we serve a weekly menu of industry commentary based on what the market has to offer. I'm Andrew Friedman from Tokeland.com.
I'm Jimmy Bradley from The Red Cat.
You are probably listening to this show sometime in the late winter or early spring of 2017. We're not quite sure when it will air, but we had an opportunity to pre-record an episode with someone we've wanted to have on the show, I guess probably, Jimmy, since we created the show.
Day one. Inspiration.
And that guest is the legendary Chef Jonathan Waxman. Jonathan, thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Andrew. You know, legend means you're probably dead, by the way, just so you know.
Living legend, Jonathan Waxman.
Dear friend, culinary icon, and cantankerous gentleman.
I'm not going to say celebrity chef. We got to do better than that. That would just be sad.
Well, yeah, there is something to be said for celebrity. But in the days of Trump, let's change that word,
yeah,
shall we?
So I'm sure 95% of our listeners know who Jonathan is. But Jonathan, of course, is with Barbuto Restaurant in New York. Is and has been involved with some other projects around the country, places like Nashville, Atlanta, San Francisco. In the past, of course, was the chef at Michael's in Santa Monica during a very important time that we'll talk about in a little bit. Worked at Chez Panisse prior to that. And then among other pre-Barbuto projects was another very important restaurant, the original Jams, which opened in 1984 in New York City. And we'll talk about all that in a little bit. But, you know, Jonathan, what we'd really love to, since you know, this is a national show, although we're here in Brooklyn. You know, it seems Jimmy and I were talking about you have a very well-defined style. It seems to have been solidified for a long time. When I think about your food, you're one of a handful of chefs, and I hope you take this as a compliment because I mean it that way. You know, it reminds me a little bit of the way Clint Eastwood makes movies. You know, it's very self-assured. It's been pretty well set for a long time. It still works really well, and he still makes movies that come in and, you know, are number one in the box office, right? So I'm leaving Clint's politics aside. I'm talking about, you know, what's on the screen. The question that we wanted to start with you was, when you have operated in these different, you know, Atlanta, New York, San Francisco, these are very different places. How or how not have you altered what you do in these different localities?
Well, thanks to the high praise with Clint Eastwood. I don't know if I could ever live up to that, but thank you, Andrew. I think the most difficult thing is cultural. I think that I have obviously a very predetermined idea about how to cook, right? So you go to another place, like London, for instance, and you have your vision of what you want to make, then you go to the market and look at what they have. And even if it's the same chicken that you want to serve, you realize it's totally different. It's raised differently. It looks different. It doesn't cook the same way. And I think that's the hardest part right there are the ingredient differences. The second part is, you know, your staff. Your staff is entirely not the people that you're used to. You know, when in New York, there's a certain type of individual that comes to work in a restaurant. I'm not defining them specifically, but there's a certain sensibility and a certain communication that happens in New York that is pretty definable.
You're talking about a certain culture of the kitchen in New York City.
Exactly. It's not just the kitchen. It's the whole restaurant. You know, it's how everybody talks to each other. I think that it's that undefinable sort of, you know, mutual trust, I think, of individuals in the restaurant, whether it's a waiter or a front of the house or, you know, a sommelier or a line cook or a dishwasher. There's a certain sensibility that so it reminds me of, you know, why Brazil is like this homogeneous entity. Everybody listens to the same music. It's really the same culture. Some people are rich, some people are poor, but it's the same culture. And that's the way it is in New York. Everybody has a sort of a similar sensibility about how a restaurant works. And whether you work, it doesn't matter about the genre of the restaurant. It really is the type of, you know, that there's a New York style. So you take that New York style and you throw it into San Francisco and people look at you cross-eyed. Because that's not how we operate in San Francisco. We do things differently.
Can you give just a small example of the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, that in San Francisco, for instance, you know, the minimum wage is going to be $15, I think, in July, an hour. And I'm a huge fan of livable wage. I think it's super important. If somebody makes $10 an hour and grosses $400 a week, you can't live in San Francisco. You just can't do it. It's impossible. You know, if you have a family, forget about it. So I understand the whole thing. But I think because of the wage thing and people's aspirations, there's a different sensibility, a different philosophy, a different kind of focus on what a restaurant is and can be. In New York, there's a certain swagger in New York that I think is unlike any place in the world. And I'm not saying it's an egotistical swagger. It's a certain sort of self-assuredness that happens in New York. If you go to San Francisco, it's a different swagger. It's a different sort of sensibility. And it's hard to, you know, at the beginning to kind of understand it. You got to get in there and talk to people and suss it out and try to figure out. Listen, I worked in Berkeley in the 70s, and it's a much different place than it is now. And I think, it's great. The difference, but it's also daunting because you really have to adjust your sights. You can't go in and you can't be cookie cutter. You have to be very sensitive to how people operate. And I think that's like for instance, Nashville. When I first went to Nashville about 3 years ago and we opened Adele's, I didn't know what to expect, number one. But there was such a growth spurge in Nashville, they went from 250,000 people in 1985 to 1.8 million people today. Just that growth factor creates a sort of strange restaurant market. You know, you don't have chefs walking around with their resumes asking for jobs. You don't have waiters that are ready to go waiting on tables. You know, you have to create those positions. You have to nurture them. You have to educate people to get to that thing. And that's a great thing about Nashville, that, you know, people are eager to learn, but you can't expect it to be New York. If you do, you're just going to die.
So all these things that you're describing are, I guess those would influence how you get it done, right? So in terms of what you cook, right? It seems like you don't really try. Like, you don't try to second guess yourself when you go into a new city. You kind of do what you do. You might be influenced by the product. You might be influenced by the staff, but you don't try to sort of tinker with what you would naturally do to try to fit some preconceived notion of what Nashville wants or what another city.
Well, Andrew, I'm just too old to change my ways. let's just face that. Secondarily, you know, I think that when you go to a place,
I didn't mean that in a critical way, by the way.
No. I think I'm not taken in that way whatsoever. I think, you know, number one, when I went first to Nashville, I ate a lot of different restaurants and looked at what other people were doing and see what they were serving and what people were eating, and that's a way of doing your due diligence. Then you talk to the chefs and you get an idea about who the good purveyors are, and you go try to find the farmers and do all that stuff. But it doesn't happen overnight. And I think that my food is so damn simple that it's hard.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. That's really the difficult thing. We were talking about this a little bit earlier about butter. You know, butter sounds like, well, you just buy butter and you're done. Well, not for me. Like salt. I'm so weird about salt. It's my chefs look at me like I'm with cross-eyed half the times because I don't like the salt I'm using. So I look at it because salt to me is so important. Well, that's kind of weird. You know, that's kind of persnickety. And, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe people say, well, salt, salt, and that's it. I remember when I served my grandmother from Queens when I was in Michael's, and I served her this beautiful John Dory dish with all the, what I thought was a wonderful sauce and a great little side vegetable. I can't remember what it is. This is 1980. And then when Taylor said, Grandma, how'd you like the fish? She goes, fish is fish, you know? And I think there's a certain mentality about that. You know, like if you service, but you buy a New York steak and you grill it and you serve it. Well, for me, that's the, I think when I was at Chez Panisse, one thing that Alice really drove into my head was you really have to taste things and you have to understand what things taste like. And no two pieces of meat, no two vegetables, no two olive oils taste the same.
When she said thing, when you say things, you're talking about the individual, the building blocks, the ingredients.
The ingredients that, you know, one artichoke does not resemble another one. Everything's different. And I think that's the hardest part about being a chef. Looking at ingredients and then sourcing them. And sometimes you source them and you get it from the greatest people in the world, and it's disappointing.
Yeah.
It's not what you expected. Something happened along the way. They might have got too cold. They might have got a little bit of frostbite. Something happened along the way. And as a chef, you've got to be able to say, and Alice is great about this. She goes, punt, find something different.
Yeah.
Serve something. You don't have to serve that dish. If the artichokes weren't great, find something else. You know, and I think when you go into these different markets, if you have preconceived ideas about what you want to serve and you sort of have, you know, the Jonathan Waxman lexicon of, you know, what I want to serve, well, you have to be malleable. You have to be able to kind of go in and say, you know what? No, that ain't going to work.
Right. So before that, you know, speaking about your style continually, you come up in a time when more is more and the classics are the classics. And, you know, it was more about consistency than originality. And people didn't mess with the classics. You perfected them and you served them proudly and so on. So, you know, you just said your style is so simple. Where's the switch? When do you flick the switch? When do you realize that, you know, the path that you're studying isn't going to be the path that you choose to take?
You know, I think that's the hardest thing, Jimmy. I think that you know me, that I can switch on a dime. You know, if I don't like the way it's going, I'll take a right-hand turn when no one's looking.
You reserve the right to change your mind at any time for any reason.
And you better have your seatbelt on because you know that I'm going to make that turn.
Yes, and, firsthand.
You know, and I think that I don't waste time in that respect. And maybe it is a little bit like Clint Eastwood, you know, like sticking to your guns and all of a sudden like, you know what? That actor is not working out. I'm going to get someone else to do the job. And I think that sometimes you have to be sort of honest with yourself that when things aren't going well, that you have to make a change.
I mean, this is the piece that you can only really get through. Like you talk about Alice's influence on you. This is kind of the thing that you're only going to really get through time in a kitchen, right? Having people, you know, this is that kind of, for me, this very romanticized aspect of being a chef, right? These are the things that are, you're not going to get this in cooking school, right? This is what you get being taught, mentored in kitchens by people who are taking time to convey enough to you that at some point you have the confidence, right, to know those artichokes aren't good enough or to know this just doesn't feel right today, right? I mean, that's,
well, I think
that's kind of, listen, the unteach, that's kind of the,
Andrew, I was very lucky. I got to go to Lovren in Paris in the 70s.
Yep.
And it was a magical time. It was magical. It was the time when, you know, all the French chefs were, you know, like Roger Ferger and Michel Girard and all these people were the vanguard. They were the Young Turks at that point. And so they were celebrating ingredients in a much different and less static way. They took Escoffier and kind of, instead of throwing the book away, they tried to remake things in a lighter, more modern style at that point. But also it was the respect for ingredients. I remember that, you know, that you know, it wasn't just, okay, well, you went to the same butter producer all the time, the same guy that you got your carrots from the same. You went and looked around at different people that grew carrots, or different people that raised beef, or different people that raised chickens, and you looked around and you became very discerning. And then you started looking at different techniques and about, you know, how to change the classics to your own style. And I remember when going to the Trois Gros restaurant, and I was blown away by not only the simplicity of it, but the intensity of the ingredients, that everything had flavor. Everything was delicious. Everything was cooked perfectly. Things looked great on the plate. And I said, wow, that's amazing to me. And then I went to Freddy Girardet, and Girardet was the first person that sort of took me to another planet.
What was it about Girardet? A lot of people talk about him almost in the way you just did. You know, like, there were all the Nouvelle Cuisine sort of honchos, right? And then they'll go, there's a pause, and then Freddy Girardet. And it just, there's this almost transcendence the way people talk about him.
Well, I was in school, and Gregory Usher, who's long gone now, was a real student of French cuisine. And he said, I heard about this guy in Switzerland. And I hadn't been to Switzerland before. I didn't know what he was talking about. And so all of a sudden, it was the mystery guy. You know, the guru you wanted to find out about. You wanted to go on that journey to find out.
Make the pilgrimage,
yeah. or find out what was up. Was it nonsensical? Was it real? And so when I finally went there, and ate there, and it was very different. Number one, it's very Swiss. Everything is clean, precise, perfect, you know. The room's clean. The waiters were immaculate. When I ate there with Alice Waters, she goes, it's like a little museum of French cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
I love that description of it. And remember, I was the first time I ate there, the Trois Gros were eating at another table. You know, it was kind of crazy. But when I ate one of the dishes, and it was just a simple seared foie gras with a gastric sauce made with a little bit of vinegar and the emulsified juices of the foie gras fat and a little bit of greens, and that was it. And I ate this dish, and it was perfectly cooked on a perfectly warm plate. The foie gras itself was immaculate. Everything about the dish made you want to have another one. Give me another one right away, you know. And then you went the progression of all the dishes. And when I got through eating that first meal, and I go, this is magical. This is why I want to be a cook. This is my aspiration. This is where I want to be. I want to be able to cook in this, not in this style so much, but with this kind of integrity and tradition, but also with, it was Girardet's style. It was his interpretation of that kind of food.
So that was one of these moments where you see, it's a cliched word, right? But when people talk about inspiration, you saw the world broadened a little bit, right? You saw a path maybe that you didn't see. It kind of flipped a switch in you and activated it, right?
It was more than a switch. It was kind of like a full body vibration.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, people would say transcendental. It really was. It was like dropping acid. It was like something crazy happened. You know, listen, I was a musician for a long time, and when I went to see someone who I'd never seen before, and I heard them play, like Rassan Roland Kirk. I saw Rassan Roland Kirk, and I just couldn't believe it. This is a guy, he was playing three instruments at once, making them all work, and laughing, and he was blind. I mean, like,
right.
The world changes.
You didn't see the world the same way.
Yeah,
after
the world changes. Yeah. You can't not be affected by that.
Yeah,
and that's what happened when I went to Girardet, and I went back many times. And you know, he would let me in the kitchen sometimes, let me hang out, and I remember the one meal that was not Girardet like that, because I'd eaten there a couple times, and he said, "You know what? Tonight you're not eating my food. You're gonna eat the way I want to eat." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Don't worry about it." And this is the true what we ate. He had this double champagne wine bucket filled with ice all the way to the top, and there were 12 perfect oysters from Brittany, little bellons, like perfect. And then we had this little soup, and it was like a traditional Swiss soup of just vegetables and little like cream broth. And then it was a leg of goat roasted in the oven with a gratin of potatoes. And that was it, a little jus on top. I mean, to pull that off and make it perfect.
Yeah.
Was extraordinary.
Now, is this something he just did for you, or was this
he did? He just did it for me.
Yeah. Because you do hear these stories sometimes about certain chefs, you know, back in the day who operated in a certain mode, but then, you know, for certain customers who they knew could appreciate it, you know, they'd have food more along the lines of, you know, what you're talking, you know, the grand mère cuisine or whatever you want to call it. They had a little bit of that sort of for special guests.
Yeah, I think, too, that he trusted me by then as a customer and as a cook. He was able to show me what his inner soul was a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's what he would sit down with his family and eat.
Yeah.
And also was like, you know, was this perfect, you know, leg of goat that only existed in that season. And he wasn't tour de force kind of things. It was a precisional type of thing that came really from his heart and his stomach.
Yeah.
That's what he wanted. I could tell he wanted to sit down at the table and have a glass of wine with us. And I think that was really kind of pivotal for me.
Great. You're sort of known for a long time as, I mean, obviously you play the mentor role to a lot of people. You know, this is information that's been out there. It may not be that well known. I mean, you've connected a lot of people up with opportunities. You put Thomas Keller onto the French Laundry space in Yountville when that restaurant was for sale when Thomas was down in Los Angeles. You connected Alfred Portale up with a job at a then failing restaurant called the Gotham Bar and Grill, which was about to be sold. Where does that come from for you? Where does that sort of instinct to be a connector, to be a mentor? I mean, you came into this industry at a time. I mean, that's sort of maybe, again, that's maybe a bit of a cliche now to talk in these terms, but you came into this industry at a time when this industry for Americans was being created in this country. What made you want to be that person to people, and how did that become part of just who you are?
Well, I think it's a Jewish thing.
That's so funny because I privately believe that, but I would not have said it out loud.
And I think, you know, it is a Jewish culture thing where you do everything you can in an altruistic fashion. That's just important.
Okay.
You know, that you help people out regardless of, you know, how you might not even like that person, but that person is in need and you know that, whatever. But it's much more than that. I think, you know, listen, I love my business, but when I first got back from France and I started cooking at Domaine Chandon, and I realized that there weren't a lot of people like me. And it's sort of like the whole Johnny Appleseed thing where you have to start planting seeds everywhere. I realized that, you know, that I had to really help create more cooks, more restaurant managers, more sommeliers. I had to help with that production of people because I really felt that the industry was going to grow exponentially, which it has. I didn't know why it was going to do that, but I had a strong feeling that it would. I thought people would really want to, you know, be that way. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, I love seeing people connected. Like Jimmy Bradley told me this funny story when he came to apply for a job for me, and I said, Jimmy, what are you up to? And he goes, well, I have this opportunity to go work in Alba, Italy, for it's a family thing where, you know, I can go work at the Pia Cesare Winery, and Pia Buffa, my cousin, offered me a position, so I'd go there and hang out. I said, you're considering a job working for me or going to Italy? Are you stupid? And, you know, and I tried to push it. I tried to push him to go to Italy, and I felt because that's something I would have wanted. I would have wanted that experience.
It was a very polite way of not being hired. I'll say that. But I left the building without a job.
But, you know, in truth be told, you know, when Thomas came up to, I had Restaurant Table 29 in Napa at that time. And he said, Jonathan, I really have this vision of a Relais and Chateau style restaurant. And what that really means is, like, you know, the old-fashioned one where, you know, by the side of the river you'd have this place where, you know, it was a romantic inn with some rooms, and, you know, in the summertime you'd have a patio, in the wintertime you'd light the fire and you have, you know, guests sit around the fire and you would cook. And
that restaurant might be the only reason that non-residents were coming to that town.
Right. And, you know, it was a place that was worth the detour, basically. Right. That's what they say in the Michelin Guide. And I looked at him. I said, well, I think I know the right spot for you. Let's go. So I hopped in my Alfa Romeo with him, drove him up to the French Laundry. And we knocked on the door, and I think Sally Schmidt was there that day. I actually don't remember the details. And, you know, you could just see Thomas just fell in love. He just says, this is me. This is exactly what I'm looking for. You know, the romantic 1890s or 1880s, you know, stone building on the side of the road in this quaint little town in Napa. I remember it was like a spring day, and the sun was coming out, and, you know, there was mustard in the field. And you could just see that he was walking on air. I said, there is one problem with this place. He goes, tell me. I said, it's $1.5 million. And at that time, in 1991, 92, it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, he goes, I'm going to make it happen. And he did.
Yeah. It took him a long time.
It took him a long time. Yeah. And, you know, but he, you know, if you know Thomas well, you know that he's not going to take no for an answer. And he's going to get it done. And he got it done, and look what's happened. You know, he did get Laura Cunningham in the deal. I sort of passed it on to him, and his maitre d' was still there. You know, it's kind of funny, but I love seeing that connectivity. I think, you know, that you know how the industry grows because we're all connected,
right?
You know, Jim and I laugh at sometimes when we say, you know, what connects cooks really is that we all speak cooking. That's our language. You know, if the worst thing happened, all my restaurants closed and I went bankrupt and my wife kicked me out of the house and my kids, you know, turned their back on me, I would take my little knife roll and go to the Maldives Islands and cook.
Yeah. Like we were recently in Italy, and when we arrived back, I forget where we were, but a couple people were saying, you know, how was it? What do you do? What's this? How do you do that? La la la. And, you know, one of the things that just kept coming back is, well, what we do is when we do, you know, trips like this is we eat, we drink, and we talk about eating and drinking. Right. Some of our three favorite things to do. So
yeah.
Jonathan says, you know, that's talking cook, but, you know, it's
sharing
stories.
Is it not? I mean, it's also that bond is you guys are kind of in your own, I mean, cooks and chefs, you're in your own. You're on your own schedule. You're on a different schedule from most people. You're in a different work environment than most people. It really is this sort of parallel universe that exists, you know, right in our midst. We can all see it. You go to a restaurant, especially with all the open kitchens that exist today. But there, it's the life, is it not? Like it is the rhythm of that life. I think you know, I think cooks and chefs understand each other in a way that it's almost impossible to if you haven't done that.
There's, Andrew, I think what it comes down to is trust. And going back to this whole, like when I was a lover and going, having all these great, you know, French instructors, and they were amazing. And, you know, when you get out in the real world, the fantasy part when I was at school stayed with me. In other words, the romance, the history of food that I learned in school, that was as important as learning how to cook. And I think when you take the, you know, the history of what food is and how it's evolved, and now we're at a much more rapid and furious pace, the world has shrunk culinary-wise. I mean, it's really become a dense society of food. I think that I always hark back to, you know, what was it like in the 30s? What was it like in the 50s? What might have been like? I love, like, watching Downton Abbey and looking at the kitchen seats. Love that.
Yep.
I love the people that are taking the time in these, you know, movies these days to show what cooking was like in a different era and how it's evolved or not evolved. You know, how it's sort of we've taken sort of shortcuts, and we should think about that. And maybe we shouldn't do the shortcuts. You know, back in the day when they would churn butter, you know?
Right.
You know? That's a crazy notion, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what's your job today? Go churn that butter. And the cooks, they would look at you like, are you out of your mind?
Every now and then somebody pulls it off. You know, you got a guy like Kinch, like you were talking about salt, you know. He sends a fisherman out with a bucket and gets some deep sea water and boils it up and turns it into salt. He takes one of his cooks and says, you know, pound the cream until it turns into butter.
Well, it was funny. I was just in your old stomping grounds. I was in San Francisco. Inauguration Day weekend, and we went to, I'd never done it before. It's actually, I highly recommend this to anyone listening. The Alcatraz tour is amazing. And we were listening to the audio tour, and one of the few violent eruptions that happened at Alcatraz that wasn't an escape attempt was they were serving the same pasta every day, spaghetti. And one day they served it just one time too many, and the inmates went nuts in the dining room.
That's staff meal at certain restaurants.
So food is important. We are talking with Chef Jonathan Waxman. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to introduce a new recurring segment on the Front Burner, Anatomy of a Dish. When the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew comes right back.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com, and as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
Welcome back to the Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew. We've been talking with Chef Jonathan Waxman. So, Jonathan, we have a segment we've had in mind for a while. We thought there would be no better chef and dish to break it in with than you. It's called Anatomy of a Dish. And we want to talk a little bit about a particular dish. I mean, people would call it a signature dish, I guess. And how maybe it happened and how it's changed over the years. And obviously, you are very closely, I think you said to me, you know, there's going to be a picture on your headstone of a chicken. You have been doing a chicken in various forms since you were at Michael's Restaurant, which you arrived at in 1979. You were there for the opening, obviously. You were the chef there. But what can you tell us? How did this dish come to be, and how's it morphed over the years into what you serve, you know, in more than one place now, including here in Barbudo in New York City?
You know, I always think about, you know, the musician that has to play, you know, that song that was his biggest hit, or
right. This is your piano man,
you know, and everybody wants to have it, and you know. I never get sick of it, to be honest with you, but I do get a little bit weary from thinking about how many chickens lost their lives in my cuisine. You know, listen, this is the weirdest thing. You know, my grandparents started a chicken farm outside of Petaluma in Cotati, California, Sonoma, in the late 40s, early 50s. And, you know, every weekend, my parents would drag me up to the farm, and I remember this is a true story. My grandmother would have a bandana around her head, and she'd be polishing eggs to send to the market. And I said, "Wow, this is a strange sort of affair." And anyway, so I was surrounded by chickens from an early age. By the way, my grandmother was the worst cook, and she, I don't know what she did to those chickens. She obviously hated them, and she brought
and
her
and that showed in the egg. Kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. So when I went to Michael's, Michael was influenced by another chef, Jean-Bert Trenu, who had a restaurant called L'Hermitage on La Cienega, and he had a chicken French fries, sort of a bistro style dish. And Jean was an amazing guy, and he was sort of the he was a direct connection to the, you know, Michel Girard and those people in France, and that were that I had, you know, had been admiring when I was in France. And so this is sort of his take on a sort of a something a classic bistro dish, but he in the California style. I think he roasted it. I can't remember, and he served it with sort of a matchstick style potatoes. So Michael goes, "Look, we're gonna sort of do a riff on that and do sort of the same thing." So we got these nice chickens. I can't remember where they were from, and we boned them out completely. And then because the center of Michael's cuisine became the grill. I don't know how that really evolved into that. I cooked everything on the grill in those days. We started grilling the chickens and serving them with these frozen French fries and a tarragon butter and watercress. And so I must have served a ton of those when I was at Michael's. So when I opened up Jan's in 84, I decided, well, you know, people like that dish, so I'll do my own version of it. And Larry Forgione had given $10,000 to this guy to raise chickens in upstate New York and put in Paul Kaiser. And Larry goes, "The chickens are ready now." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Well, I'll send you some." And they were like the most magnificent birds you've ever seen. And they cost $15 back then. So you can imagine that, you know, how much love went into these birds. And they were huge. They would come in, they had amazing subcutaneous fat and everything. Anyway, so I started cooking them. I boned them out the same way I did at Michael's, but I started cooking them on a charcoal grill, real fire. And I started making real French fries, and the French fry recipe that I came up with was so convoluted and silly. My chefs hated me. And here's the other weird thing. I was so pedantic about things. I didn't want a classic deep fryer. I did a rondeau on top of the stove because I wanted everybody to understand how to do French fries from scratch.
Yeah, I can speak to that point.
Now, when you say on top of the stove, you mean you put the rondeau on the grill?
No, on the stove. On the stove.
On the range.
Yeah, on the range. And, you know, it was just my way of just being, you know, kind of a dick. But the result was pretty magnificent, and people seemed to really enjoy it. The chickens were amazing. And I remember this funny story when right before the restaurant was opening, Jim Nasikas from the Stanford Court Hotel and Danny Kaye came in for a pre-opening luncheon. And I said to Danny, who was a friend of mine, I said, "Danny, you know, these chickens are so damn expensive. I want to charge $23 for them." And that time was...
That was scandalous. People still talk about how expensive that dish was.
And he goes, "Jonathan, rents are high in New York. Fuck them."
But isn't that also...
And I'll tell you, Danny Kaye gave me the confidence, honestly, just to move forward. One of the things, he was the most brilliant person I've ever met, but he's the funniest guy, and he just gave me the sensibility that, you know what, go with your gut. You know, do what's the right thing. Anyway, so that became a real sort of a signature dish, so to speak. Gail Green got it wrong. She said it was roasted when it was really grilled. Anyway, so roll forward to today's time. When I opened Barbudo, I wanted to do it differently. And I was, number one, I wanted to be more simplistic. So I took these beautiful birds, actually not from Paul Kaiser anymore, but they're from Lancaster County. And we took these really great birds. And I decided, why am I taking the bones out? And all my chef friends go, "Oh, people never gonna eat chicken on the bone." I said, "Well, they do it all the time. That's how you eat at home." Right. So I decided
the kernel serve.
So I just cut the chicken in half, you know, took out the backbone, and served the chicken. And here's the goofy part of it: it's sort of half grilled and half roasted. Depends on the mood, the moment, the chef. As long as it comes to the most important thing, guys, is that it has to be basted. Basting is everything, and even to this day, some of my chefs don't get the basting part. they sort of half baste it, or they get lazy and they baste it for a second. But basting is everything. And the basting part, you know, creates that when the subcutaneous fat starts boiling underneath the skin and creates that crispy, beautiful skin. And everybody goes, do you season them beforehand? Do you brine them? I don't do any of that stuff. We just salt and pepper them.
Right.
And put them on the grill and then the oven. And, well, here's another important part of it. It has to be, they have to rest. And also it's the size of the chicken. You know, gone through so many permutations of what how big the bird should be, and it has to be about 3.75 pounds.
Right.
That's kind of the sweet spot.
To me, you know, this is the moral of this story is kind of attention to detail. You know, you change it however you want to change it, but really it goes back to you looking at it and saying this is perfect. This is how I want it or not. So I work with Waxman at Bryant Park in the early mid 90s, and you know, I'm asking him, how do you want me to do this? How do you want me to do that? What's this? What's that? And he's, you know, at a certain point, he's like, look, you got the job. I trust you. Just do what you're going to do. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. Then I'm making chickens for lunch one day, and he's like, this is all wrong. You suck. And I was like, come on now. You just said something different. And so he didn't say anything else after that. I used to get to work at 8 o'clock in the morning. He used to come to work at 7 o'clock in the morning.
5 o'clock.
we used to cook, you know, 180 chickens a day, you know, so before noon, you're into 90 or 100 chickens, and he's got 50, 60 chickens laid out and the grill lit, and he's cooking them and breaking a sweat. And he's like, this is how you cook a chicken. And I was like, yeah, I know. I make 180 of them a day. And he's like, yeah, but you're not making them like I make them. And so I was standing there watching them. And, you know, really, the moral of the story is, it was a very busy restaurant. And I was trying to execute on all these levels. And I was rushing the chickens off the grill, you know. Right. And so another 2 minutes, and it was exactly the same way it was supposed to be each and every time.
Sure.
And, you know, it took me and him at 7 o'clock in the morning for a week for me to, like, let it settle in that really, if you just spend an extra 2 minutes on everything, you won't have to do it do it again.
Go ahead.
Well, I think the moral of that story really, and Jamie, I appreciate that. That's pretty candid. I think that that timing thing is super important. Andrew, I don't know if we ever talked about this, but, you know, cooks are a little bit like other people that are performance-oriented. You get into a bubble. You get into your own world, and time sort of stops around you. And nothing else really affects you when you're cooking. And what Jimmy's talking about really is, you know, that I needed him to be in my bubble. I needed him to show how I can stop time. And how I can create a dish without failure because I took that extra two minutes or what it was. I didn't think of it as the minutes per se, but what it was that it's take the time and do it. Stop yourself. Don't rush it. Don't compromise ever. As soon as you compromise, you're done.
That's great. I heard somebody said something to me last night, and I just immediately thought of you. Somebody said, no one can stop time, but the great ones can figure out how to slow it down.
Yeah, I think it's really what it is. And you know, like this, I've been doing a lot of TV shows over the last few years, and people say, well, how come you're so relaxed in front of the camera? And I said, well, the camera doesn't exist for me.
Right.
Time stops.
Well, this is the jazz musician in you, right? I mean, you were a trombonist. You actually gigged around and
I think it's part of it, Andrew, but also I think that you have to be comfortable in your own skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never more comfortable than I'm in front of the stove. I just did a thing in Las Vegas for a Spotify convention and for the CES, and I was on stage, and, you know, afterwards the host goes, how can you talk, tell jokes, and cook at the same time?
Right.
You know, and I didn't think about that, but it you know,
you're flowing.
You're in your own zone.
Yeah.
If something happens that you control your own destiny at that point. And they said, well, how do you get it so you know it's going to be right at the end of the day? I said, well, you have to keep tasting, you have to slow down time, and you have to not compromise.
Yeah, it's you know, this kind of brings the whole conversation full circle, right? Because we were talking about you and having this very well-defined style. You just said comfortable in your skin. I think that dish to me has always been emblematic of that. You know, that is a dish that has survived, I mean, you know, I don't even know how many. Probably need more than two hands to count all the little sub, you know, genres and eras and
survived eight presidents.
You know, but, you know, it came up at a time where you were on the kind of the edge of the kind of anything goes in the 80s. And, you know, and it's you know, the molecular era or whatever you want to call that. And, you know, and it's like Cher. It's like there. It's still there.
I'll take Cher.
I'll take Cher. I didn't, you know, probably a better example than that. But it's this thing that, you know, has just seemed trend proof. It has seemed trend proof.
But it has evolved. It right. has evolved, and you know, and the economics are interesting now that I charge less than I did
right.
back in the day. But back in the day, when Larry's Chickens with Paul Kaiser were an experiment, they were something that they were, you know, opening up the world to a different mode. And then people followed. I mean, I think it's the farmers and the people that raise food, you know, are putting things up on a pedestal now.
Yep.
And I think that's, a lot of people don't get that, you know. I always think they say, you know, they always say that was the original sort of farm-to-table chef. So what else is it, you know?
Right.
Is it,
it's, well, it. I know a lot of guys of your generation who that term and the fact that it's come into vogue in the last few years really irks them because they're like, we were all doing that. We just didn't put a name, to, you know, we didn't call it that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I abhor like buying things in a market covered in plastic.
Yeah.
It really bothers me.
Yeah.
And I think because on a lot of levels, but I just don't think that food needs to be processed so much.
Yeah.
And we really want to, you know, process things. And I think that, you know, the people around the country that there's lots of these little restaurants that you find out about, and they've been doing this thing where they have their own gardens, their own ranches. They've been buying stuff for years, and they've been cooking stuff from these people, and that's magical.
Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've had been talking with Chef Jonathan Waxman of Barbuto and other restaurants. It's been a pleasure. You can follow us on @ChefPodcast on Twitter. You can also follow The Front Burner with Jimmy and Andrew on Facebook. And I believe that's it for this week, Jimmy. For The Front Burner, I'm Andrew Friedman.
I'm Jimmy Bradley.
And we'll see you back here next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.